cycling podcast Femina in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Waar zijn we, Orla?
We zijn in het Rafa Café in Amsterdam.
If my Dutch is correct, you just said that we're in the Rafa Café in Amsterdam.
Yeah, I don't think you need fluent Dutch, thankfully, to be able to say or understand that. But yes, we are in the Rafa Café in Amsterdam. Lovely, isn't it?
It's really nice, really nice. Over three levels.
Yeah.
The Rafa Clubhouse, of course. We're drinking a nice coffee here. We're watching a cross bike. We're surrounded by cross bikes. We're also looking at Service Canavan's very dirty jersey from Paris-Roubaix in 2001, which he won. Of course, his bike is there as well. You'd have thought they would have cleaned it.
Oh, terrible. Yeah, it's really cool, actually. I like this spot. It's in a lovely historic part of Amsterdam as well, an area called the Nine Streets. And it's a lovely old building. It's very atmospheric.
Where's Rose, is the question.
Yeah, Rose is in London. I mean, London, that's so passé, isn't it?
Well, we're here. We've been visiting you, Orla, for your birthday. Rose is missing this month. She'll rejoin us next month. In fact, it might be Rose instead of you next month, depending on how things work out, because you're going to give birth to a little Dutch baby soon.
Yeah, I am. I'm currently growing, obviously, a new friend to the podcast, due in January, so I might be out of action depending on when that decides to show its little face.
Hopefully the timing will be good in terms of recording schedules and so on.
I'll try to coordinate around our podcast schedule, yeah.
But this month, Orla, you're not going to hear too much from us because it's this episode for December episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is basically a long interview with Ashley Mulman-Passio, who I went to visit at her home in Banyoles in Catalonia, not far from Girona, where she and her husband have bought an incredible old house and land where they're building a cycling centre where people will be able to go and have cycling holidays. They're putting together a kind of performance lab. Really exciting plans they have, and looking forward to visiting there again once it's all up and running, although I think people are going there already. But yeah, I went and spoke to her, and we'll hear that interview. You've listened to it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful interview, and Ashley Mulman-Passio was always so interesting to listen to, I think. I think it's probably not much of a secret, we really like her on the Cycling Podcast, partly because she's been in the game a while, but she's, as is common with a lot of the female peloton, she's got so much going on off the bike anyway. She gives an awful lot of thought to things, so she doesn't necessarily just issue an easy soundbite on any of the, shall we say, virtue signalling type topics that tend to do the rounds with women cycling. She always has something intelligent to say, and she's always worth listening to, I think. A wonderful rider to watch as well, and someone I've been behind for the last couple of years. You want to see her get that big win, you want to see her, you know, break, well, I guess through to the top of the podium. But yeah, it was a really interesting interview, I thought. Very wide range and covered so many things, from her new team to her old team. Talked about, I suppose, relevant to where we are at the moment, Marianne Vos and teaming up with her next year. Really interesting interview. It was great.
And I think she's, I don't know if it's unusual, but she seems to be able to relate to the young girl who started out on this journey and wasn't a world-class cyclist, and almost can't believe, I get the sense that she almost can't believe that she is in the position she's in now, where she's one of the world's best. I think she appreciates that, doesn't take it for granted, and enjoys it, and is determined to make the most of it by moving on to a new team and giving herself a new challenge next year. Shall we hear from her now? Let's cross over to Banyoles and Ashley Mulman-Passio. The news came out recently that you're changing teams, and I think that caught a lot of people by surprise, because you've been so identified with Cervelo Bigla over the last few years as their leader, and it seems to be, you know, a team that you've grown with, and a team that's grown with you as well. What prompted the switch? What's the thinking behind it?
It wasn't an easy decision. It's not something that I just took lightly. Of course, Cervelo Bigler has almost become my family, or, you know, I often refer to it as my team, you know, small team, big hearts. It's been a special place for me, and it's a place where I wasn't actually only a rider. You know, I actually took a lot of responsibility in other ways within the team. There was actually a time in 2015 where it actually took my family and myself actually investing something in the team to save it, because the team didn't manage to find a second title sponsor in that year. So it's a team that I've invested a lot of effort and money into, if we want to call it that. And, you know, it's produced good fruit in that it's a team where I really grew as a rider. You know, joining the team in 2015, I'd come off a really bad year in 2014, where just, you know, health and everything was against me. And so 2015 was the first year that I really, you know, made my mark in the peloton and sort of entered into the top 10 world ranking. And since then, I've been in the top 10 world ranking ever since. And yeah, this year has been my best season, you know, reaching third and now currently fourth in the world ranking, and just having a really good, consistent year. It's been a great environment for me, and I'm very grateful for my time there. But at the same time, I think that change stimulates further growth, you know, and I think that's sort of the thinking behind it, is that, you know, I've reached a really great level in the sport, but I would still like to reach an even higher level. And I suppose I just have the feeling that, you know, changing environment and having some new challenges can stimulate further personal growth and hopefully can make me an even better cyclist, you know. And that's a tough call, because I'm really happy with where I am at in my cycling. And so that's the difficult position, you know, is that you adapt to an environment and it's a good environment for you, but at the same time, you know that maybe you need something different or something more, you know. So it's that fine line between staying in the environment in which you're comfortable with, or maybe pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone to reach even higher. And I suppose that's just what I decided. You know, we all know that growth doesn't happen in a comfort zone. So, yeah. You know, and having said that, I mean, the objective of the team also is very much to develop young rider talent. And so there were also some big restrictions. The team essentially was also struggling, you know, to continue to afford a big rider like myself. And although money is not my biggest motivation, you know, I have a huge passion for the sport, and it's love of the sport that fuels and motivates me. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm not getting any younger. So, and a sporting career is a limited period of time. And so I suppose it's also important, you know, to really make hay when the sun shines.
Yeah, it's a problem in cycling, isn't it? That if a rider does well in a team, that rider costs that team more money. And that's a problem. I guess what will happen, or what you imagine might happen in your new team, is that when races get really tough and the group is whittled down, you might be in a position with teammates, which you maybe haven't had so often in the last couple of years. There's that situation you sort of relish, because there'll be moments where perhaps you have to play the teammate and not be the leader. But at the same time, there might be moments where you're able to go and get that big win that you've been promising as well.
Yeah, so of course I would love to win more. I mean I perform consistently, and I'm often second, third, or fourth, or fifth, you know, or top 10. But it would be great to win more races. And yeah, I mean, it's not a given, obviously, moving to a new team. But you know, there's a lot of depth in experience when you join a team that's been headlined by Marianne Vos. I mean, she has such a huge wealth of experience and knowledge in cycling. And I suppose there's also that kind of mindset. You know, I actually started cycling much later in life. I only started at university. So, you know, I've really only been at the, you know, professional or full-time side of the sport for the past 10 years. So it was actually a very fast growth in the sport for me. And it was something that I put my mind to. You know, I wanted to make progress fast, and I'm proud of the progress that I've made. But I very quickly went into leadership positions, you know, and I'm actually not the most experienced rider in the peloton. So I also believe that I can learn, can still learn a lot from a rider like Mariana Voss, who has incredible experience. She's been doing it since she was 5 years old, you know, and she just has this amazing situational awareness. You know, she just kind of knows what to do in any situation. And so, yeah, I think that's a huge motivation, going to a team like that when not all the responsibility potentially rests on me as a rider. Of course, you know, in Sevilla Bigler, we also had Lotta Lepisto, who was an incredible sprinter, and lots of young talent coming through. And that was very rewarding, you know, to be part of that development. But at the end of the day, the responsibility was very much on my shoulders. And so maybe to be part of a team where I'm not the only one responsible, and can maybe take a sort of a step back from that and focus more on taking the risks or taking opportunities when they present themselves, I think that could be something interesting for my riding.
And, you know, on paper at least, you and Mariana Voss, very different talents. You know, suited to very different types of races, although she's usually there. I mean, how well do you know her? How well have you got to know her over the last few years?
I actually know Mariana quite well, in that in 2014, I invited her to come out to South Africa to take part in the 947 Cycle Challenge, which at the time was not a UCI race. But, you know, there was still quite a competitive women's field, and I was racing, and it was just interest to attract more international sort of talent, or to bring exposure to the race. And so I invited Mariana to come out and to experience it and to race. And so that's where I really got to know her well, you know, very well for the first time. But actually, it's quite amazing. I was thinking back, really, when the team was chatting to me about a press release, and it just kind of struck me that when I first started cycling while I was still at university, and then, you know, my first season in Europe was 2010, but I actually broke my collarbone 3 times in that season, so it wasn't really a consistent or continuous season. But I got to know Martina Brass actually quite well, because she had ridden for Lotto, and that was the team I was riding for. And so, I don't know, she just sort of took an interest in me for some reason, and she would give me advice, you know, and sometimes it was quite critical, but it was good, you know, to get that feedback, to be able to improve and to make the changes. And anyways, it was in 2011, you know, the Dutch team used to come out to South Africa every year to do their winter training camp, and they were staying very close to where I lived at the time. And so Martina got in touch with me and said, hey, why didn't you come join us, you know, for a day, ride with the Dutch team? And it was, for me, you know, at that stage of my career where I was so new and so green, I was starstruck, you know, wow, you know, opportunity to ride with the Dutch national team, and one of which, of course, was Mariana Voss. And what they would always do is, there were, I don't know, about 16 of them, or I don't know how many in total, but they would split up into smaller groups of 3 or 4, you know, so that they would have a harder workout. And I ended up in a group with Martina and Mariana, and it was just the most amazing experience, you know, at this early stage of my career, to have the opportunity to spend the day riding with Mariana Voss and actually chatting to her and getting her advice. And I still remember that so clearly, you know, and she was just so amazing, the way she was very friendly and very willing to share or to give advice. And ever since then, of course, you know, I've always been friendly to Mariana, and she's always one to smile and greet, you know, and so I've always looked up to her as a cyclist because of that. You know, she's a really approachable, humble person, and she really cares about the people around her, you know. And then to have gotten this opportunity to get to know her better in 2014, and then to also get to know Anton, her brother, and her family, you know, ever since then, it's always whenever I'm at a race and Mariana's dad's there, which he is often there, mm-hmm. he always comes over and chats to me. And not that I'm best friends with her, but I've always had sort of quite a good understanding of her and her family and what drives her. And so then now to be presented with this opportunity to join her on a team, it's pretty amazing. You know, I'm really honored to be able to join forces with Mariana, and to think that in a space of sort of like 9 to 10 years, the progress that I've made, to be going from the young, really green, inexperienced rider that just was dying to get any feedback I could from Mariana, just dying to have the opportunity to ride with her, to be able to join her team as a co-leader. I mean, I'm really proud of the progress I've made, and yeah, I believe this is an important step in my career, and I'm really excited about the opportunity.
You might have to pinch yourself next year if Marina Voss is leading you into the Mur de Huy or something, you know, to set you up for Flesh Alone. Did you speak to her then about the team and about this opportunity to join forces? Is that something you've had a conversation with her about? And was her presence there a really key factor in you moving as well?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you join a team with Marina Voss, I mean, it's just a given that it's going to be a high-performance environment. You know, the experience that I've had in terms of, you know, riding with her in the early years on that one day in 2011 to inviting her to come out to South Africa to race the 947, which she then came back to do the next year, and actually eating meals with her in the days before, seeing how she prepares. It's very evident that she's a performance-driven athlete, and that there's huge attention to detail in everything that she does around her racing. And just if you know, looking at the team from the outside, it's also very obvious that it's a very professional environment. And I suppose this year maybe, and past 2 years maybe, I've displayed a little bit more interest. There's always been a desire or a natural like kind of fit that if the opportunity presented itself, that I would happily ride on a team with Marianne Voss.
It's the same team, but with a new sponsor next year, CCC, who also have a men's world tour team. Do you know how that will work and how much integration there'll be between the women's and the men's teams?
Yeah, so actually, at the time of potentially, you know, well, of signing with the team, I wasn't actually aware of the CCC deal. I knew something was happening, but I wasn't really sure of the details of it. And so, yeah, of course, we were informed before the official press release went out, but it came as a surprise. It's not something that I was particularly expecting. I think it's really cool, and I'm excited about it. I think that, you know, that the team structure and the way in which it's run and managed and its service course and all that type of thing will stay exactly the same. So it's going to remain more or less a Dutch setup, but of course with a Polish title sponsor and with a relationship to the men's team. I mean, we're still uncertain exactly how close that's going to be. Of course, the team management will be totally separate, but we have been told that it will have more or less the same look and feel, you know. So I think sponsors and equipment will be very similar, and we yet to see how closely we work together. I mean, two separate managements means that the team will be more or less run separately, but maybe the opportunity arises that there's a training camp together or a press release together. We'll have to see how that goes.
And Marion's experienced something similar before, I suppose, the Rabobank, you know, where there was the men's and the women's teams.
Exactly,
In terms of teams, at least, like there's a bit of a step change next year for women's cycling. We've got the new Trek team. I mean, it looks like there are going to be a few, I suppose we call them super teams almost. Mm. CCC, Trek, Bulls Dolmans, of course, Canyon SRAM, Wiggle will be disappearing. Mm. But the Trek team looks an interesting one, doesn't it? I mean, they've made some really good signings. It looks like it'll be a really strong team, and that there will be, those teams look to be all on a kind of level, don't they? On paper,
yeah.
At least.
So I think that there could be somewhat of a sort of levelling of the playing field. Of course, you know, Bulls Dolmans has been the most dominant team for the past few seasons, and I think that could change next year. As you say, you know, instead of all the really great riders being on one setup, it's more distributed throughout the peloton, or at least four or five teams. So I think that could make the women's side of the sport even that much more exciting. And yeah, I mean, women's cycling is just growing every year, you know, in terms of the level of our performances. I think it surprises more and more people when they actually have the opportunity to really watch or pay attention to women's cycling at how high our level is. So, you know, we professional athletes, we take our jobs really seriously, and we're really proud and committed to what we're doing. So I think that's becoming more and more evident. And yeah, I think it could be quite exciting to see somewhat of a distribution of the strength, so that, you know, there isn't one team that's winning all the races, but there's opportunity for more to. And it's great to see sponsors like Trek, you know, moving over to the women's side, and even CCC, you know, moving over to the women's side. And that seems to be somewhat of a sort of trend that is happening more often. There's talk of more men's teams that are potentially going to penetrate into women's cycling in the years to come. So that's definitely something that's positive to, for the sport. But, you know, there's pros and cons in everything. So, you know, if you take a team like or a sponsor like Trek that's now entered into women's cycling, that also poses certain challenges, especially for the smaller teams. So, and that's the interesting thing in women's cycling is that, you know, in men's cycling, you know, market value is maybe, you know, a more sort of defined thing, whereas in women's cycling, market value is very much, it's dependent on the sponsors or the teams involved, and it's changing quite drastically from year to year. And although that's great for the sport, it's kind of a big challenge for the smaller teams or the teams that have maybe been around for very many years. And that's sometimes the sad thing to see, where you see the, you know, the smaller teams that have committed to growing sustainably, developing talent, you know, and they're in it for the long haul. You get a big sponsor that suddenly enters and totally changes the scene in terms of market values, and the smaller teams are the ones that suffer, and they're the ones that have been around for the longest. So that's kind of the difficult position women cycling is in at the moment, and I think that's even quite evident if we look at just at my current team, you know, Cervelo Bigler, who's losing Cervelo next year. And then obviously, you know, the bigger teams, Trek has come and bought up Lotta, CCC, I'm going to CCC. So Cervelo Bigler is potentially losing the riders that they've developed over the past 4 years, to be honest. I mean, Lotta has also developed in the Cervelo Bigler team. So that's the challenge, is a very real thing in women's cycling at the moment. And it's kind of a difficult position really to be in, because of course there's a lot of value that men's cycling can add in terms of exposure and pushing women's cycling forward in terms of like big sponsors like Trek coming in and CCC coming in and sponsoring the sport. But there is of course the concern that if at any point these teams or structures are in difficulty financially, most likely they'll cut the women's side first, you know, and then we might have lost some of the smaller setups which were in it for the long haul and in it purely because they wanted to be in women's cycling. So that's kind of the difficult position we're in now. And I suppose one's got to hope for the best and believe that the new bigger sponsors that are entering into the sport are also in it with a long-term vision to really grow women's cycling. So yeah, that's the difficult position we're in, and it's something that I find quite difficult, because I'm, on one hand, I'm very much a believer that women's cycling needs to create something for itself, you know, and that we kind of need to take charge of our own growth, because for that to happen properly, it needs to be done with a real belief and passion for the sport, and not just a, oh well, you know, let's follow the trends, you know, equality is the new big thing, so let's get into women's cycling. But at the same time, we all know that men's cycling has a massive following, and that there is value also in sort of piggybacking off that to a certain extent.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Sam PK reminds me to tell you that this month's episode is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist, Orla.
Yes, of course, The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business, science, technology, arts, and even, of course, sport. The Economist helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them. And in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. Now, Richard, I'm looking at the article you've got in front of you just now. It's an interesting looking one. Do tell.
Yeah, I don't want to indulge in national stereotypes at all, Orla, but it's an article that headlined Opening Time, subheadline Pubs in Ireland. I thought this would be something you'd have a view on. Did you know there are 7,000 Irish pubs worldwide? I thought there were more, actually. 8,403 on the island itself. But what I didn't know was that in Ireland, the system for opening a pub, the protocol you have to go through, is that a new pub can only open once an old pub closes. There's a sort of licensing system which restricts the number of pubs that are allowed to open at any time.
I'm really surprised by that, because that must be a fairly lax system to a certain extent. Well, maybe not lax, but the threshold must be quite high. I mean, I come from a very small village, and among our village and townland there are more pubs than there are greengrocers. You're certainly not struggling for a pub anywhere in Ireland.
Nevertheless, in The Economist, they predict that there will soon be more Irish pubs outside Ireland than there are in Ireland.
That wouldn't actually surprise me that much. I'm kind of surprised that there are more pubs still in Ireland than there are outside Ireland, because I always just thought it was going to be something of a fad, or it was something of a fad, to open up Irish pubs everywhere you go. But they are still opening absolutely everywhere. We did a boat tour in Amsterdam on Saturday and went past Molly Malone's, for example. I mean, you cannot go to even any random town around the world practically without finding an Irish pub. I mean, I'm intrigued as well, though. I don't understand the international attraction of them. Maybe that's something for a non-Irish person like you, Richard. But I wouldn't be surprised if and when there are more non-Irish pubs than there are pubs in Ireland.
It's Ireland's second greatest cultural export after Orla Shinoe. and the listeners to the Cycling Podcast Femina can get a free print copy of The Economist. It's a smart guide, of course, to the forces changing your world. And to get your free copy, text BIKES, BIKES, to 78070. That's to get your free print copy of The Economist. Just text BIKES to 78070. This month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is also sponsored by beer52.com. How would you like a free case of craft beer, Orla?
You're asking the wrong lady, but if I was a beer drinker, then yeah, be lovely, thank you.
Your husband drinks a lot of beer.
He does, yeah. We keep him quiet, so yeah, please.
As a listener to our show, we'd like to thank you for listening with the help of our friends at beer52.com. And to claim a free case, all you have to pay is the postage, which is £5.95. Go to beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle. I am a Beer 52 customer and I get my case delivered every month. This month's theme is the Southwest, and that is not anywhere exotic. Well, it is quite exotic. Southwest of Britain. So down the Southwest and Bristol and all the rest of it. And I was most interested.
Have you just done a Lionel and alienated a swathe of our audience?
I'm trying to roll back here.
Yeah, I noticed that.
This is an interesting beer company, Moor.
Yeah, wonderful. Missing the E, but sticks and bones, like that.
Bristol Brewery, Moor. I've been sampling a couple of their beers. They've got very interesting dark ales. And one at the other end of the spectrum I tried was the Wild Beer Company's Sleeping Limes. And that is it's like a lager with limes and sea salt. Very refreshing, surprising, and fruity. I enjoyed that one a lot. So to stock up for Christmas with a free case of 8 delicious craft beers, just visit www.beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com, the word beer, the numbers 5 and 2.com/cycle, to claim your free case today. Now back to Ashley Moulman Passio. Ashley, I wonder if you can tell me about this place where we're sitting. I mean, this is, you said this building had some history. It's an old looking setup here on the outskirts of Banyoles. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And right. How long have you lived here in this part of Spain?
This is our sixth year living in Girona province. But my husband and I have never actually lived in Girona town. We've always chosen to be a little bit outside Girona. And Banyoles just sort of happened coincidentally. You know, we were living in Italy because Carl, my husband, has Italian heritage. And so that was the first, natural move, is if you're coming from South Africa to make a career in cycling in Europe, well, let's go to Italy, because he wanted to explore his heritage. And it was great. We lived in northern Italy, in Varese area, close to Lago Maggiore. But somehow we just kind of felt isolated there. You know, we were making effort to learn the language, but we just didn't feel that we were really integrated into the community or accepted into the community. So it was a case of riding your bike and then going to your apartment and sitting in your apartment all day, and it wasn't fulfilling, So we were looking for somewhere new to base ourselves. And obviously I'd heard a lot about Spain and Girona area. And Carl had actually had a really bad experience coming to watch a race in Valladolid area somewhere in Spain. And so he was like completely against the idea of coming to Spain, because that was his idea. But of course, as we found, as from living here is that we actually don't live in Spain. We're in Catalonia, and it's actually very different to the rest of Spain. So finally, I managed to convince him to come out here. And at the time, he was kind of taking part in triathlon because that's where his sort of roots are. And so we were looking for something closer to water or where he would be able to swim. And so we ended up in Banyoles, and we're just so grateful that we ended up here, because we've always somehow been, you know, studied in a smaller town in Stellenbosch in South Africa. You know, Carl grew up in a smaller town in Knysna, as did I, in the center of South Africa, Bloemfontein. So we've never been sort of big city or people to be in the hub of the noise and activity. So to be based in Banyoles, which is just outside of Girona, it's a half an hour ride into Girona. We have always had a car, so it was easy enough to drive into Girona to join friends and to be there when you wanted to be in amongst everything that's happening, but to be able to leave when you wanted quietness. And you know, cycling is also, it's a full-on sport. When you're with your team and you're racing, you're immersed in it, you know, and it's just all about cycling. And then to come home and to be still immersed in that, because that's essentially what Girona is now. I mean, every corner you turn, you bump into a pro or a journalist or a photographer or, you know, so Banyoles is the perfect environment where it's still very much a local experience. It's a local town with people bringing up their kids, but it's a very sporty town because we have the lake, you know. So it's actually a very popular destination for triathletes. Many international triathletes come and spend time here during the season. And yeah, it's becoming more and more popular for cycling tourism. So yeah, I mean, Carl and I, you know, we both come from studying and engineering degrees and just sort of took the opportunity to explore a life as professional athletes. And that's turned into a proper career. And so, you know, it started, I mean, we're both in our 30s now, and the thought started to enter our minds, you know, what are we going to do after cycling? You know, we love our life in Europe. We're not so certain that we want to go back to South Africa permanently. So what do we do in Europe? You know, there is obviously the language barrier. You know, how do we make opportunity for ourselves here beyond cycling? And of course, it's possible to go back into engineering, but that means starting at the bottom. You know, we have no experience practicing as engineers. So, you know, in our 30s, we have to start from scratch, you know. So the thought was, well, what can we do that kind of benefits off our years in cycling and our experience and our network in cycling? And so, yeah, I mean, the dream was always to own a property here and to, you know, to start a cycling tourism business and to somehow connect the dots between maybe the different aspects or spheres of cycling, being those that are making money, like cycling tourism or events, and the pro side of the sport. And I suppose that's where we hope to eventually get to, that point where we can connect the dots. But the opportunity just presented itself with my dad retiring sooner than what we thought, looking for something to keep himself busy. We came across this amazing property.
Well, I was going to ask, how did you find this place? Because it's at the end of a gravel road about a kilometre. You must have had a few punctures along there, have you? Or
actually not. No? Yeah, yeah, it's
fine gravel, but yeah. It's very remote, very cut off. It's got beautiful views here for miles, you know, to the town itself and the Pyrenees. But how did you come across this place? How did you find it?
I mean, the mindset just started, okay, well, we're looking into a property, a masia, which are these stone, you know, country villas in the Girona area. We always wanted to be close enough to Girona that people could experience the hub that it is, or the cycling hub that it is, but that much more removed that, you know, you can just cycle out of the property and straight away be on good training roads without having to cycle through a town. But we didn't want to be so remote that people have to come here and it's dinner, bed and breakfast type of establishment. So, you know, we contacted an estate agent to start looking around at properties. And funny enough, she said immediately, she'd listened to what our requirements were, and she said, well, I think it's a bit bigger than what you want, but I have to show you this property because it's just come on the market. It's actually it's quite a historical property in that it's been in the Campulia family for hundreds of years. It's a very prominent property in Banyoles. It kind of overlooks the whole town and the lake. And they owned, obviously, a lot of the town. It was a farm. But over the years, they've sold off. And so at the moment, it's a big manor house with two sort of what would have been workers' cottages and 35 hectares of land. So you said it's a bit bigger than what you're looking for. But it was left to the oldest son. He has no family. His parents have died. And he's desperate to get rid of it. So I think you should come have a look. And I walked into the courtyard as you came in, you know, under the arch into the stone courtyard, and it just took my breath away, and I was like, I have to have this place.
When was this?
This was, it happened really fast. So, I mean, this was in September.
Oh, wow.
Last year. So we walked into this courtyard, and it was actually in horrendous condition because, as I said, it was left to a guy that was all on his own, and he literally was just looking after his parents. And outsourced the farming and did very little to maintain the grounds, which I think you can see are quite substantial. And so, you know, the pond outside was totally overgrown with reeds, and you actually didn't really, the stone of the courtyard wasn't so well exposed, was quite overgrown by the grass and, you know, all these things. And a lot of people that come here now, I mean, everyone that comes here is blown away and they fall in love straight away. But a lot are really surprised how we managed to see the potential, you know. And I suppose that's sort of just, I suppose it shows in terms of, like, even just my cycling career. Carl and I somehow have always been up for a challenge and have been able to see potential in the unknown. You know, when we first announced our ambitions, you know, to go overseas, and Carl would confidently say that Ashley will become one of the best cyclists in the world. And a lot of family or friends or acquaintances would think, you know, whatever, you know, that small, you know, kids with big dreams, you know, because we were young, in our 20s, early 20s at that stage. But I think we've really, really impressed a lot of people to show that we delivered. You know, we had a vision and we managed to realize it. And I suppose we just kind of, you know, bringing that into the next phase of our life, which is identifying this property as a place with a lot of potential, and especially a lot of potential to realize the aspirations or that the dreams that we have in terms of our careers in cycling going forward.
And to build a business. And I guess is exactly. The idea then to have residential accommodation here for groups to come and stay, and what scale will that be? I mean, how many people will you be able to accommodate here?
Yeah, so currently there are three buildings on the property. We are sitting in the main manor house, which the ground floor is the only sort of livable space of the manor house, but it has a level below and above. But we have another two masias, one of which is a family home, and the other is beautifully restored into a 5-bedroom ensuite villa. So the idea for that one is it's perfect for groups, so of 4 to 10 people to come and sort of take over the whole villa, use it as their base to explore the beautiful area and the amazing training we have in this area. And then this big manor house will eventually be converted into some bed and breakfast rooms and also some sort of self-catered sort of smaller apartments, maybe for 2 to 4 people. So at the end, our maximum capacity could probably be between 30 to 40 people, but currently we have 14 because there are two rooms in the manor house with a shared bathroom and a kitchen that we are renting out. And I mean, the next big step we'll actually be making is to renovate the lower floor into a coffee shop, a workshop, and we actually have some quite exciting stuff that might be happening around a high-performance testing facility. You know, there's somewhat of a need for it in the area with a lot of pros that are based here and also just a lot of triathletes that come out to use this as their training base and preparing for age group Ironmans or anybody who wants to come out here and experience maybe a place where the pros come to be tested or to drink their coffee, but also to be able to use those facilities themselves. The dream for me is for it to become a service course as well of a professional women's team. I mean, that could also be a men's team, But of course, my
would you like
big
to,
motivation.
Well, would you like to one day have your own women's team? Would that be a dream of yours?
It is a dream, yes. Yeah. It's something that's sort of quietly working on in the background. Whether it happens or not, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, maybe it means, you know, joining forces with an existing team or enhancing an existing team. But yeah, the dream is to have a team that is based here, that this is a service course, that riders are staying here on and off in between races or for training camps. And that is potentially going to happen next year already. So CCC are displaying interest in using the facility for training camps. And I mean, that to me is I've always been looking at ways to kind of connect the dots in cycling. You know, I feel at the moment it's very much sort of removed. You know, you have pro cycling that's kind of struggling and trying to exist on its own. And then you have cycling tourism, which is becoming a huge, you know, industry in cycling, but it's also kind of more or less happening on its own, and you have events happening also on its own, and at the same time you have, you know, brands which are trying to access the people that are buying the bikes, but, you know, pro sport is not necessarily ticking the box for them anymore because it's not really good enough for the pros just to be riding the bike. You need, people want to touch and feel and experience, so there's that aspect, you know, having a rental bike fleet which people can come and actually experience the bikes for themselves. And the idea is to eventually connect all those dots, you know, to have, if the bike that the pro team rides would be the rental fleet at the property. The property is a facility that the pro team uses, but that the everyday cyclist can come and see how it works, see how a service course works, see the big buses parked outside, or see a rider having their VO2 max test being done downstairs in the cellar. So that's the long-term goal, and we're just trying to sort of tick those boxes.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
A big thank you to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast Femina. And for all your sports nutrition, you can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. A big thanks again to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast Femina. Now back to Ashley Moulman-Passio. I mean, do you feel that you're still, you've just had your best season. Do you feel that you're still improving? Do you feel that there are still things, have you identified already things that you can do for next year to make you better than you were this year? Is that just happening all the time?
Yeah, so I'm still lucky to be in a position where I can actually see, you know, growth every year. So I'm still on an upward trend. That's evident in various aspects. So if I'm looking at my training and my power numbers, you know, there's still growth happening in that. And then, you know, just in terms of tactical knowledge or experience in the peloton, you know, becoming wiser, smarter, racing smarter. You know, I still believe that there's many things that I can improve on. And you know, cycling is all about, it might not be massive jumps anymore or massive gains, but, you know, we all know that there's huge value in marginal gains, which is often referred to in cycling, and all the small things add up at the end of the day. So, yeah, of course, as I still feel that I'm continuing to improve and grow, it still motivates me, you know, to continue to perform at the highest level. But a perfect situation at the moment where I have the ability and the opportunity to continue to perform as a professional athlete, but at the same time I'm also fulfilling another desire, which is to feel that I'm building something else at the same time. You know, for me, I suppose that's always been somewhat of a challenge, you know, having come from a highly educated background into professional sport. There's sort of the mental aspect or keeping the brain active aspect, which has always been very important to me. And there's been times in my career where people have tried to change that, where coaches have said that I'm too distracted or I need to eat, sleep, breathe cycling, and I need to cut all these distractions out. But I've actually realized through the years that I thrive on it, you know, to keep the brain somehow engaged as well, and to see something happening, you know, in my personal life and in my future at the same time.
Well, it's interesting, you've had your best season while presumably you've been doing also quite a lot of work and thinking about this place. Is it giving you a sort of a security maybe that you feel that you need in a, you know, this, what you're talking about earlier about thinking beyond cycling? Because I guess being any kind of professional sports person is the most insecure profession that there is.
Yep.
And for somebody like you who you might be unsettled by that, having the security of a long-term plan, has that made a difference this year?
For sure it's made a huge difference. I mean, if we, you know, over the past years, you know, when Carl and I first came to Europe, I was going to pursue a career as a professional cyclist, and he was going to try get back into triathlon, which is what he grew up doing, and he was a very good triathlete. But he ran into all sorts of obstacles around, you know, injuries and his feet and all this type of things, which eventually, you know, he was mature and wise enough to acknowledge that he wasn't going to make it. You know, he tried as well in cycling alone, you know, to make it professionally, but it came to a point, you know, men's cycling, if you haven't been in the game from a young age to get into it at the highest level, it is quite hard because it's so competitive. So, you know, he made the decision that it was best for us to focus on my career. But, you know, that presented challenges in itself. You know, I've been very blessed to have Carl's support, and he's really thrown himself into my career, which has allowed me to grow so quickly, because I've had, you know, he's got such a natural aptitude for high performance sport, you know, and tactically he's really smart, and he's just a great athlete, you know. So to be able to have learned from him daily, you know, he throughout my career has trained with me, he's even, you know, worked for the cycling teams that I've ridden for in the past. And so, you know, that really has been amazing in my career. But it started to get to the point where it was difficult for us as a couple, because he wasn't really seeing where he was going in this whole, you know, I was starting to become more and more independent as a rider, although he continues to train with me many days. You know, he wasn't so actively needed anymore in my career. So that started to present a huge obstacle for us, you know, what, you know, Carl was starting to doubt our career, not because I wasn't successful, but because what were we going to do afterwards? And what has he done, you know, with his life? If we stop my career and he looks for a job, you know, what is he going to put on his CV? And, you know, and I'd reassure him on numerous occasions that, you know, he's played such a huge role in my career that is something that he can present to people, you know, to have been able, he's the one that recognized my talent and pushed me, you know, to try, you know, or to pursue this career, you know. So to have, to be a person that can have vision in something that hasn't been realized yet, I mean, that's a huge talent. But anyways, to cut a long story short, I mean, that started to add also a lot of pressure on my career, because I felt a huge responsibility. You know, we as a couple had made really big sacrifices to make this happen. And then to kind of rest with that sort of responsibility on your shoulders at every race, that I wanted to perform because I wanted to prove that this sacrifice had been worthwhile, you know. And that's not a nice responsibility to have. And I really felt that in the Rio Olympics, where that responsibility actually completely overwhelmed me and to the detriment of my performance. And luckily, I was able to recognize that. And, you know, we're also very, very fortunate that things have worked out in our favor, in terms of, you know, my dad and stepmom have made a complete move over to Europe to help us with this project, to invest with us in this property. So it's a family commitment, but it's been huge in terms of just, you know, creating a longer term vision for both Carl and I. You know, it's something that he's working day to day very hard on. It gives him huge motivation every day. And at the same time, it does for me too. You know, it allows us, you know, and now I go away to the races, and although it's great, you know, there are times when you have to focus really on you know, just eating, sleeping, cycling, you know, and to be able to get into the form that you want to for a race, I really thrive on this, the distraction in a way, you know, to have something else that I'm working on or thinking about, because in a way that helps me to perform better, because I'm very much a thinker. And if I overthink things, it's often to the detriment of my cycling, because cycling is essentially a sport which is governed by instincts. You should be making decisions in the moment. And if I've spent too much time thinking and planning and visualizing a race or a scenario, then often it's to my detriment. So building this business at the same time as you know, pursuing this career, I think, yeah, it's been a big part of why this year has been such a huge success.
So, yeah, it's really interesting. It's sort of, in a way, taking a pressure off while putting a pressure on. But pressure can be good as well, I suppose. Yeah. It can be a positive pressure.
And everything complements. Mm. You know, the two, you know, the business and my career complement one another, of course. If I'm performing, then it attracts more attention to the business and vice versa.
Yeah, so, which is another interesting way of thinking about it. Yeah, that you're a kind of a salesperson in a way for this project that you're setting up. And the best way to draw attention to it is to perform well in races.
Exactly.
Other races, you know, Flash Malone, you've gone very close to Giro Rosa. What would be on your wish list? What would be number one? I presume a rainbow jersey would be number one, or Olympic gold medal would be number one. But what are the things that really drive you and make you dream?
You know, for me, it's not only about winning bike races. Of course, it's amazing to win a bike race, and it's a feeling that nothing else can replace. You know, to cross that finish line first is super special. But at the end of the day, for me, there needs to be something more. You know, I'm maybe quite a deep person, if you want to call it that, and I'm not really one that's driven so much by extrinsic motivation. So, it's, you know, money and fame and fancy things don't really catch my attention. They never have. You know, Carl often jokes that I know nothing about cars, or the one joke is we stopped at a traffic light and I said, "Oh, wow, look at that." And Carl said, "Oh, the Ferrari." And I'm like, "No, the puppy." You know, so there's stupid things like that. But anyway, so I'm not very motivated by flashy things or that type of thing. I'm intrinsically motivated. And, you know, for me, just the personal growth that I've experienced in professional cycling is huge. You know, if I look at the person that I was before I started my career and who I am today, it's worlds apart. You know, I was actually a very shy, timid, insecure person. You know, I came from eating disorder at school, very academic, loved sport, but never really managed to find the sport that suited me because I was always too small and not strong enough, you know. And then to finally, through Carl, find a sport that clicked, you know, that I was obviously talented for.
Why did it click? What was it about cycling? And especially if you'd tried other sports, and what was it? What was it about cycling? Was it, I don't know, I mean, you talk about this in a bit in the chapter you wrote for the book, how his encouragement was a big factor in it as well. But what was it about the sport itself that clicked?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, at school, the common sports were hockey and tennis and swimming and athletics, you know. And, you know, I always had good athletic ability. I was fast. I had good endurance. But, you know, hockey was the big sport at school, you know, in South Africa. And I just wasn't strong enough, you know. So a lot of my peers were bigger than me. You know, also growing up in South Africa where the year runs January to December and I'm born in December, it meant I was actually a year young, you know, much younger than a lot of my peers. And I also was someone that developed later in life. So I was always small and petite, fast. But yeah, I just didn't quite find the sport. And like tennis was something I was good at, but I didn't have that winning edge, you know. So I'd always crack under the pressure and couldn't finish it off. And then, yeah, meeting Carl, and he was a triathlete and trying that. And swimming, I was just hopeless at. Like, I can swim, but I'm not fast. And running, I'm good at, but I just kept getting running injuries. And then it came to just riding. And one thing Carl and his father actually did notice was the first holiday I joined them, you know, in their hometown in Iceland. They're a very sporty family, and every morning they'd go out for their bike ride together. And, you know, I didn't have a road bike as such, so I borrowed my mom's like hybrid, which is sort of a cross between a mountain bike, I suppose, like a gravel bike in a way. And I just had my normal shorts and my sneakers, no cleat-in shoes, and I joined them. I somehow had the guts to join them, even though they were all on their fancy bikes and cleat-in shoes. And we rode up a really steep climb in the area. And as we arrived home to Carl's family home, I overheard his dad saying to him, you know what, that girl's really got talent. You know, she was incredible on that climb. You know, you should really pursue this with her. And that's where it kind of started, you know. And that's how we identified my talent for cycling, is that I was a good climber. And that's essentially how my career started, that I'm an amazing climber and I was going to be a grand tour rider or a tour rider. And, you know, I'm thankful that I managed to also realize that I'm not only a climber. You know, I'm also a good classics rider, and I've also proven my ability in the time trial. So I'm somewhat of an all-rounder, but my biggest strength is climbing.
So that was the first piece in the jigsaw on the, exactly, on the board, and everything else.
So followed. I suppose that's where my small petite size, but so strength
was, and was that something that almost you felt was a disadvantage in life, and in the sports that you tried,
exactly,
suddenly
it became an advantage.
It was something that, exactly, and so you started to see it more positively.
Exactly.
And would you say that, I mean, if you say you were a shy, kind of insecure person back then, you know, has the confidence that you've gained through cycling
definitely
affected you, your whole personality?
Exactly.
Changed your personality?
So I've always been a big thinker, like I said, and I've had ideas, but I didn't necessarily have the confidence to speak them out loudly, you know, or to voice my opinion to the whole room. So through cycling, and it's obviously through Carl's belief in me, you know, so there were times when we'd have arguments because I'd do a local race in South Africa and it would start up a climb. And I dropped off the lead pack, and I'd come in the top 20, but off the front group. And Carl would say to me, "What happened?" And I said, "Well, you know, I gave it my best, but I couldn't stick with them. You know, they're just so much better than me." And Carl said, "No, you didn't give it your all." And I'd be like, "How do you know?" Okay, I mean, we used to literally have arguments about this. I'd be like, "You're not me. Like, you're not in my body. So how can you tell me that I didn't give it everything, you know?" And I'm telling you, Ashley, you don't know how to suffer.
And was he right?
He was 100% right. So we'd have these arguments about it over and over and over again. And then it just came to one race where I suppose it clicked, where I realized, and I suppose it was through training, where he pushed me a little bit further and a little bit further. And I started to learn how to suffer, or how to go into the red and to push through that, you know? And I think that's actually an art. That's something that doesn't come to every person naturally, you know. And so I'm very grateful that Carl kept persisting on that.
So that was almost a eureka moment, an epiphany, realizing,
yeah,
that,
exactly,
actually the whole point of it is to suffer and to hurt.
Exactly. And just to learn to go out of your comfort zone, you know, to learn to be comfortable with that feeling. Because, I mean, that's the body's natural way of saying, okay, this is enough, stop. You know, and most people listen, but as what makes a high performance athlete a high performance athlete is the fact that we don't listen, you know, and we learn how to become comfortable with being uncomfortable, you know. So yeah, it was that epiphany, you know, that I eventually then realized that this is a talent, it's something that I need to pursue. But then still, I mean, I had to still overcome that other obstacle, which was being quite reserved and quiet and didn't really believe so much in myself, you know. And so, yeah, through the years and through other people believing in me, and in particular Carl, I learned to believe more in myself. And then as you get more and more success in your sport or in cycling, you know, that builds confidence. Yeah, it just it, through the years, I've really changed as a person. You know, I've become a stronger woman, you know, physically, but also, you know, mentally and in character. And that's what I really love about this journey and about this sport, is that I really believe that that is a huge part of women cycling, is that it is actually a form of empowerment. And that's really satisfying to see how, and I see it in a lot of women. Like if I even take Lotta as an example, you know, we kind of grew together in the Cervelo Bigler team. And I remember Lotta, I mean, at the point that I joined the Cervelo Bigler team, I was already quite a strong person, and I'd grown a lot in character and confidence. But Lotta was very insecure and timid and uncertain, and I used to remember sharing room with her, and you know, and she'd be like, "What do you think of this? Oh, you know, I'm not sure if I should do that. Oh, what do you think?" You know, and I'd have these conversations with Lotta a lot, you know, and then just to see how she grew and became this amazing sprinting superstar, you know, and it's just really wonderful to see that, you know, and that's a huge obstacle that faces women in any sphere of life, is that we often just lack the self-confidence and self-belief, you know, to take that next step. And so I really believe that cycling is a huge platform or tool for self-empowerment, you know, for women.
It's just interesting to contrast it with men's cycling, but maybe men's sport or even other sports where there are more opportunities for women, more money for women, because it's almost as if, you know, the group of fellow professional riders who you ride with have all probably been on quite similar journeys in a way, in the sense that they've not been, you know, there are some male riders who've been very, very well supported from a very young age, almost institutionalized, and sort of take it for granted a bit. And they haven't gone through that same learning experience, perhaps, because they haven't had to.
Yeah.
And so in a way, that the poverty, in inverted commas, of women's cycling is almost... it almost benefits those who can come through and thrive in that world.
Exactly.
This is not an argument for there to be, you know, less sponsorship, less money in the sport. But it is interesting that, you know, inevitably, if you make it in that sport, you've been on a very tough journey. You've been driven by passion, but you've also probably gained an awful lot as a person through that journey as well.
Exactly. So that's starting to change a little bit now in women's cycling, because, of course, now it is... you know,
you'll get more pampered athletes now, will you?
In a way. And you get the younger athletes now that are coming in. And I'm somewhat grateful that I've, you know, gone through this journey. And it sounds silly to be grateful for challenges and obstacles and stuff like that. But it does form you as a person, and it does form your character. And somewhere, everyone will have a certain amount of challenges or obstacles, even if they... you know, come into the sport now where it's already on an upward trend and it's a proper career path and they can make money from it. I'm talking about the younger female riders now. There will be obstacles along the way which will have to form them. But, you know, obviously it has been harder for a certain group of us. And in particular, it's particularly hard coming from the Southern Hemisphere, you know, from South Africa, because, you know, I just had this conversation the other day with someone. Like, I'm really dependent, obviously, on my earnings in my professional trade team. Okay, things are changing a little bit now for me because I'm building something else. But a lot of the European riders take for granted, or even those coming from the UK, that they're so close to home that they manage to monopolize a lot more of their fame or their support in their home countries, whereas for me that's a real challenge, you know. So in terms of personal endorsements, it's not as easy to have a personal endorsement when you're living in another continent, you know. You can't just go to the car dealer down the road and appear for an evening talk or that type of thing, you know. And although I'm becoming an international athlete and I am supported by an international fan base, Your biggest support or opportunity is always going to be in your home country, if we call it that. So, yeah, for me, it's always been a challenge. And when I first came to Europe, I wasn't paid a salary for the first 4 years of my career. I wasn't paid a salary by my international team. I was paid purely from small endorsements or a local team in South Africa. And that was a huge challenge, you know, to I had to be really inventive to think how do I satisfy the people back home when I'm when my real passion is Europe. So I'm spending majority of my time racing here. So I was kind of racing two seasons, you know. Obviously different continents meant, you know, it's different cycling seasons. So I'd start the season in South Africa, which was the summer but winter here, and then I'd come over here, spend the whole winter in South Africa competing in Europe, and then I'd have to go home and continue to do some racing there, you know, to be able to sustain the support I was getting from back home. It was actually only in 2014 that I received my first paycheck from a European team. So, I mean, I was very fortunate that I'd come from a university degree, and I could apply some of the skills I'd learned through chemical engineering. We had to write a lot of reports to present, you know, the findings we'd come to through some experiments or stuff that we'd done. So I'd learned how to put together a professional report document, and that proved to be very handy when it came to writing business proposals or sponsorship proposals, you know, for example. But, you know, I had to be quite inventive, you know, and I learned a lot through the process, which a lot of the younger writers now are not going to have to do, you know. So, you know, in a way, like, I feel that that helps, because it makes you a more rounded person, and it helps you to be able to take on the challenges that present themselves at the top end of the sport, so injury or failure or whatever it might be. So it's a changing time in women's cycling now, because there's definitely opportunity for youngsters to come into the sport and to start earning quite well from quite early on in their career. And there is a different mentality now, and I hate this, because I hated the fact that, like, you know, growing up, that your parents would say, oh, when we were younger, you know, it was much harder and we had to do it like this and that and this. And then I sometimes feel like I'm falling into that kind of feeling, you know, where I want to say to the younger girls, you know, there's no elevator to the top, you know. You have to work hard, you have to spend enough time on the front of the peloton with your nose in the wind, you know, to learn what it takes to be the rider that's doing that, you know, or to become stronger. So I do believe a lot in becoming stronger or a better person through maybe sometimes taking the hard road rather than the easy way.
And, and it's always a sport, and we've seen it at the Vuelta, we've been watching Simon Yates, you know, it's always a sport where anybody who makes it to the top has had to work really hard, no matter how much support they've had, how much they've been paid. The ones that make it have made it, have done it the hard way, because there is no other way.
No, there is no other way. So sometimes, you know, as I said to you, so even though the opportunity in women's cycling is that much better nowadays, and it can be a real career choice for a youngster. So for me, for a lot of us, for myself, the Evelyn Stevens, the Emma Pooleys, you know, we studied degrees. Megan Garnier, you know, we have degrees behind our name, because it wasn't a given that professional sport was a proper career, you know. So, and I'm grateful that I have that behind my name, because it's another life experience which has formed me as a person, and is something to fall back on. But it's a very real reality that for the youngsters nowadays, they can come straight from school and in terms of women, and go straight into a career in professional cycling. And so there is a change now. And I've seen that firsthand, because I've been involved in a team where there is a strong focus on young rider development. And so it's a new mentality. And, you know, one has to embrace that new mentality, but there is some part of that, you know, old saying or whatever, that, you know, you have to go through the hard way to really learn. Nothing replaces experience, you know, at the end of the day. And there is really no fast track to the top, you know. So maybe there might be an element of success that a youngster experiences very soon or early in their career, but there's going to be a period in their career where they're going to have to go through the tough times, you know, to get to the top again. So
a community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa, headline sponsor of the Cycling Podcast, Cycling Podcast Feminine. We are in the Rafa Clubhouse in Amsterdam. And there's a little display off to our left for the Festive 500. which is the annual challenge to ride 500 kilometres between Christmas and New Year. Orla, you've got an excuse this year.
Well, you say that, but actually they did ask me when I showed interest in the display whether I was considering it this year, and I looked down at my belly and they were like, yeah, maybe not this time around. But it's a brilliant idea, actually. I love the timing of it. And for a lot of people, it might seem a bit ridiculous to be doing it between New Year, Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. But I think that's the best time of year because you're completely stepping away from your normal life for that week anyway, aren't you? I think time is sort of suspended slightly. And to be able to get out on your bike and work off a little bit of the excesses of Christmas over that time would be brilliant. So I may well just do that next year, actually.
Rafa,
you don't have an excuse, Richard.
I was just moving on there.
I noticed that.
Rafa.cc for details of the Festive 500.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast Féminin, brought to you by Skoda. Dedicated to closing the gender gap in cycling, one race, one cyclist at a time. This is our time.
Big thank you to Skoda for backing the Cycling Podcast Femina for, well, most of 2018. They came on board in time for the Women's Tour, allowed us to provide daily coverage from the Women's Tour, which was great fun. Looking to do that again next year and do even more next year. But we're very grateful to them and grateful and pleased to be part of their campaign to promote women's sport and to strive for gender equality in sport. So thank you very much indeed to Skoda. Orla, we've just listened to Ashley Moolman-Passio, very interesting, you see, long-ranging interview in the spectacular setting of her house in Banyoles.
I was really intrigued, actually, with her by how much she said she still has to learn. I find that really exciting because we do consider her to be one of the more experienced riders of the peloton and someone who's been there, done that. Her racing nous is well known, but to think that she could learn from Marianne Vos next year is really exciting, and also maybe that allows her to shake off a bit of the responsibility that she's had for the last couple of years as team leader and be in a position to inject a bit of excitement into her racing and not always be that team leader and take on that position of responsibility, but just race in a slightly different way. That, to me, really excites me for next year.
I got a real sense as well, which you don't often get from riders, male or female, of how normal life had got in the way of focusing on her goals, on her training, on her racing, and the responsibility of having her husband at home. And perhaps without the same focus that she has through her racing, and how, you know, setting up this centre and him really project managing this is a weight off her mind as well. I thought that was really interesting because although she's had great results over the last couple of years, especially 2018 where she was second at Giro Rosa and second at Flèche Wallonne, which is a race she's gone close to winning in the past as well, you know, a real sense of her mind being more at rest and perhaps next year we'll see a different Ashley Moolman-Passio and somebody who'll be at the sharp end of those races with allies, with other strong riders. I mean, we've talked a lot about Marianne Vos, but Danny Rowe had a fantastic year as well this year for that team, and I think she looks at Danny Rowe as somebody to emulate in the sense that she took a real step up joining Vos's team, and obviously she hopes to do the same herself.
And dare I say that speaks volumes about her intelligence, her emotional intelligence, that she's allowed herself to be distracted by that responsibility towards her husband. It's not something that you often get among elite sportsmen and sportswomen. They're known for and need to be incredibly selfish and to put their demands before and the demands of their sport before everything else. The fact that she's been concerned about making sure that her husband's happy in the life that they've chosen together is very refreshing for a start. But yeah, it also means that maybe she can have a bit more fun on the bike next year on all levels. Yeah, it'll be an interesting 2019 for her, I think.
And what's coming up from our new Dutch correspondent?
Yeah, the new Dutch correspondent, evidently, the resident Amsterdammer. Well, I'm hoping to have a little look in some way or other at the dominance of the Dutch women in women's cycling and where that's come from. What they've managed to do that other nations can maybe emulate, what it is about riding in the Netherlands that lends itself to greatness at the elite level, you know, because we see, I mean, you can look out the window here. I mean, I can count three bicycles just parked in the street in this tiny shop front, and you can see everybody cycles recreationally everywhere. But how does that translate into elite performance and how does it translate so well? So I'm hoping, I've got a potential interview lined up, but I'll dig around a little bit on that and come up with something or other in the next couple of weeks to bring, hopefully, in January.
Great. Well, this is our last Podcast Femina of 2018, so we better wish people a Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and thanks very much for listening in ever greater numbers in 2018.
Thank you very much, everybody. Have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas. If you're riding your bike, enjoy. If not, enjoy the mince pies, and we'll see you in 2019. Exciting.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.